Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to the Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we'll be talking this hour with Charles Marsh, who's a Commonwealth Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Virginia. He joins us to talk about his new book, Strange Glory, A Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, one of the most well-known Christian theologians of modern time, a huge historical figure, a pastor, a thinker, a man who attempted to be part of the conspiracy to get rid of Hitler, was a man whose work and life moved people like Martin Luther King. And Charles, welcome back. Great to talk to you again.
Yes, it is wonderful being back on your show. I have such fond memories of our conversations during my Baltimore years back in the 90s. I'm glad to know you're faring well, and thanks for the invitation.
Oh, no, we're doing well, and I'm glad you did this. I'm glad you're here with us. You know, because when we hear the name Bonhoeffer, most people really know he's a theologian, might hear Martin Luther King say his name, but we don't know the essence of a number of books have been written, as you talked about in your book about him. But this is a hugely significant figure in the lives of many in this country and Europe.
No, I agree. When we think of Bonhoeffer, we think of a great theologian or a courageous member of the German resistance. Some people know him as a conspirator in a plot to assassinate Hitler, who was murdered by the Nazis in a concentration camp in Flossenbürg in 1945. We tend to think of him as a saintly figure or as a larger in life hero. While he is heroic, and there are certainly saintly aspects of his character, Strange Glory is an attempt to really try to develop his character in a fuller, more rounded, more sort of, you know, understandable and sympathetic and indeed deeply human fashion. While having utmost admiration for Bonhoeffer, I've tried to make his life and his drama and his struggles vivid as he made this long and very difficult journey from sort of the golden child of the Berlin Grunewald, who grew up with great sense of German military valor, you know, who by 1942 was calling for the death of the madman Hitler and joining a conspiracy to assassinate Hitler.
Take a step backwards just a minute. I you know, you thought about Bonhoeffer for most of your adult religious life, mm-hmm. as a scholar and theologian. And then you had this Bonhoeffer chair. What was the university again?
The University of Berlin.
Berlin,
the Humboldt,
right.
University in Berlin, exactly.
So that's where this sojourn kind of begins. This particular part of the sojourn really begins, right? For you?
That's really interesting. No, I mean, you're absolutely right, Mark. I was lucky enough to have the chair of the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Visiting Professorship at the University of Berlin in the spring of 2007. You know, and I know that sounds like a prestigious title, but I should let your hearers know that it came with no salary, no travel stipend, and I don't think I had access to a printer. But nonetheless, I had a cozy office on Bergstrasse, which was right across the River Spree from the Berlin Dome. And soon enough, I made my first visit in Staatsbibliothek, this beautiful city library near the Potsdamer Platz, and with the help of a director of special collections, I began to work newly obtained collection of Dietrich Bonhoeffer papers. And every day I would go in and I would hold, you know, various letters and photographs. For example, in those cases was a registration form for a brand new Audi convertible, I think, that his father gave him in 1937, just as he was about to launch a seminary for resistance activists. I found a fascinating correspondence with Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi, from the spring of 1934. Bonhoeffer was invited to go live on Gandhi's ashram and to study communities of peacemaking. I found a postcard from Waco, Texas, that Bonhoeffer had written on a fascinating road trip that he took with a Frenchman in the spring of 1931. I found the inventory of his wardrobe. It turns out that Bonhoeffer was quite a fashion hound and kept a meticulous record of his clothes and shoes and various outfits he needed. An inventory of his library was much less surprising, though it was interesting to see that in his eighth or ninth letter to Father Christmas, he asked for the complete writings of Immanuel Kant, which is not what I asked for when I was 11 years old.
11 years old.
Yeah, 11 or 12. But in the course of looking at these revealing and surprising and very intimate documents, an intriguingly different image of Bonhoeffer emerged than the one that I had carried with me, you know, for 20 years since writing a lumbering doctoral dissertation on his philosophical thought back in 1989. And I felt a gentle nudge into biography.
One of the things I gleaned from this book, a number of things, was he's a very complex character. You know, this deep thinker.
Mm-hmm.
It really passionate about a Christ in terms of what the living Christ must mean and how you must live your life.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, a little monastic in his ways, but he loved mm-hmm. but he loved his silk underwear and his wine.
Right? That's wonderfully put. Yes,
I mean,
he did. He loved his. He had a way of describing faith as the embrace of the polyphony of life. And so for Bonhoeffer, as an unusually generous Christian thinker, faith was not about constricting life, but it was about embracing life in all its fullness, the pleasures, but also the sufferings, the challenges, but also the joys. And I think those aspects of his character you mentioned are part of this polyphony of life that for him was the essence of genuine faith.
You know, he came from a fairly upper-class family, really in many ways an aristocratic bearing the way he looked at life, and that even affected the way he thought. We'll talk about that in a little bit, about his view of what would make change. But one of the things, let me just jump to one piece right here, which I think is, to me, really fascinated me, because I think the way you wrote about it and the way you described it, it had a profound effect on the rest of his life and his thinking, and they happened in America.
Mm-hmm.
His time at Union Theological Seminary with Niebuhr, and
yes.
his relationship he developed in all that time in the black church in America. These instances profoundly changed his view coming from as a German scholar coming to America.
That's right. Yes, I mean all of these interesting qualities you mentioned are dramatized in that chapter. He was indeed born into a privileged family, into a family of, in fact, prodigiously talented humanists. And so at the age of 14, when young Dietrich Bonhoeffer announced to his family that he wanted to become a theologian, his older skeptical brothers responded, really? You know, a more paltry, moribund institution than the church, one can hardly imagine. And Dietrich, you rarely go yourself, to which he responded, apparently, well, in that case, I shall reform it. And by the age of 21, he had received his first dissertation. He had earned a second doctoral dissertation. By the age of 24, the great theologian Karl Barth described his 21-year-old dissertation as a theological miracle. And he was, Bonhoeffer was primed for, you know, a life of academic fame and fortune and the very demanding German scholarly milieu. But he was a restless soul, and I think with a hunger quite uncommon among German Christians to see new places and to experience life beyond his native land. And when he received an invitation from Union Theological Seminary in New York to come over for the academic year 1930-31, he jumped at the opportunity. He wasn't inclined to think the Americans had anything to teach him. I mean, he was a fairly confident, if not arrogant, young scholar, erudite and extremely confident in his judgment. It was to be another chapter in his charmed life. What happened in the course of this singularly transformative year, 1930 to 1931, is this straight arrow academic who did not think that, you know, American Protestants really amounted to anything substantial intellectually or theologically, underwent a profound immersion in the African-American church. Toward the end of the fall semester, 1930, a young black seminarian, a son of a Baptist pastor in Birmingham, Alabama, named Frank Fisher, invited this young German to visit to go with him one Sunday morning down to Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, just, you know, probably a 20-minute walk from Union Theological Seminary. And Bonhoeffer had written two doctoral dissertations on the doctrine of Christ and community and faith and religious experience, but it was completely intellectualized to him. In fact, he had never, until his first visit to Abyssinia, felt, you know, religion in his bones and in his body. And, you know, the service and the great preaching of Adam Clayton Powell Sr. was both inspiring and refined, and yet the experience also felt joyful, and there was a spontaneity, and there was a life, and there was a flow, and there was an energy. And this was an intense six-month immersion, not only in the Black Church, but in the Harlem Renaissance, which was in full flower at the time. And one of the discoveries I made in this remarkable special collections in Berlin was a very large file. I would say, Mark, it was 300 pages of notes and news clippings that Bonhoeffer had made specifically on the American race issue in 1930 and 31. And in the spring of that year, a month before, 6 weeks before he was to take the ship back to Germany, he and some classmates took a cross-country trip, and on their way back from Texas, and when they were about to head north out of New Orleans back to Chicago, and then to retrace their route to New York City, they made a decision to head due east and to drive from New Orleans into the heart of the Jim Crow South in 1931. And it appears that Bonhoeffer and this French friend named Jean Lasserre worshipped at a rural Black church somewhere south of Knoxville and west of New Orleans. And when Bonhoeffer got back to New York, he wrote a letter to a friend in Berlin. He said, "Alas, I have heard the voice of Jesus, but only in the church of the outcasts of America."
I mean, what was so significant about that is what he seemed to crystallize for him in this journey here was that the way the church was split in many ways, one of the ways it was split was around what path one takes as a Christian. And to take
That's the
path of a Christian to live the life to change the world and to head on face human suffering, he learned in the Black church.
That's right.
You know, and that
he absolutely did.
At the Abyssinian Baptist Church, no less.
The Abyssinian Baptist Church. It's very interesting. I was able to find a short little memoir, it must be no longer than 50 pages long, that Adam Clayton Powell, the distinguished pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church, wrote about that particular year Bonhoeffer was a member. And Reverend Powell said he began to imagine Jesus during that year. And this is a year that, you know, the Great Depression is sweeping over the neighborhoods of the city, that no longer is some abstract, otherworldly figure, but as someone who walked the streets of Harlem as a homeless person, as a beggar, as someone broken and marginalized by power. And Bonhoeffer would go back to Germany, Mark, and he would say this. I love this phrase. He would say, "After those months in America, I was able to make the turning from the phraseological to the real." I love that.
And he was prescient in many ways. Now, one quote you have in here where he says, "And I do believe that the Negroes will give the whites here considerably more than merely their folk songs."
I know. And he sensed that there was a movement afoot among African Americans in the South. What's also fascinating, Mark, is that many of the fellow students that these are fellow students at Union Theological Seminary in 1930-31 would return the Southerners and some folks from outside the South to a labor and then to early organizing initiatives that really plow the ground for the civil rights years to come. Frank Fisher, this Black man who chose Bonhoeffer Harlem, would take the church in Atlanta and would get arrested with Martin King in a desegregation campaign in Atlanta in the late 1950s. One young white fellow at Union who became friends with Bonhoeffer, a man named Miles Horton.
I love this story. Miles Horton, right.
You know, Miles Horton from Appalachia, East Tennessee, who once said that he had been admitted to Union Theological Seminary only because Union was looking for a token hillbilly. Miles returned to Mont Eagle, Tennessee, and established this organizing center called the Highlander Folk School.
Right.
and that Highlander Folk School helped train a generation of labor organizers in the South and Southeast. And, of course, later in the 50s, folks like Miss Rosa Parks and Martin King and Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker and this generation of sort of church-based, community-based organizers were part of the sessions there in voter registration and citizenship and nonviolent direct action. So it's this fascinating connection I made. And then one of the most remarkable discoveries I made in terms of this connection between Bonhoeffer and American social movement is that when Bonhoeffer returned to Germany after the spring of 1931, he carried with him a large collection of recordings of the spirituals, of blues, of African-American music that he had purchased in record shops in Harlem. And one of my favorite images of the German resistance movement is that of 60 or 70 young dissident pastors gathered around a piano in a semi-abandoned estate in the northeast part of Germany. What is happening here is an illegal seminary is formed to train anti-Nazi pastors. Bonhoeffer is at the piano, and he may be performing quite theatrically as he was wont to do. The fellows are holding their steins of beer and, you know, good German cigars, and they're singing "Go Down, Moses." Mm. And to realize that the same freedom songs, the same music that would energize the American civil rights movement in the 1950s was also the heart of the German resistance movement in this particular form was astonishing, but also quite delightful.
So he's in America, where he comes here not thinking very much about the intellectual weight of the American Protestant Church.
Exactly.
But he studies with Reinhold Niebuhr. He studies with men like Charles Weber, Harry Ward, and all these people.
That's right.
And so he begins to understand. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I missed you. No, I think you're absolutely right. And often in Bonhoeffer's sort of popular biography, Niebuhr and the theologians in Union appear as sort of superficial or shallow Protestant liberals. And certainly Bonhoeffer had some rather critical and kind of fussy words about the level of theological education at Union that he considered sophomoric, he wrote in one of his notes. But the fact is he was profoundly, profoundly moved by this remarkable generation of American public theologians. I mean, Bonhoeffer, for example, in Berlin, had a relationship to professors that was imperious to put it modestly. His professors were German professors, and the German academic elite lived in a separate world from the students. And at Union, he couldn't believe his eyes when folks like Niebuhr and Ward and Weber and some of these great social gospel theologians of the early 20th century were taking their students outside the seminary to get involved in social movements in New York, to get involved in the ACLU, to get involved in the NAACP and tenement housing initiatives. Bonhoeffer saw in Union and in New York a new way of being a theologian. It wasn't just, you know, pontificating lofty ideas in the classroom, but it was about the concrete engagement of the world out of faith, pursuit of righteous action, you know, and human flourishing. And so Niebuhr was a great influence on Bonhoeffer, and they forged a lifelong friendship. Niebuhr read some of Bonhoeffer's early essays that struck him as abstract and kind of doctrinaire Lutheran essays, and Niebuhr said to Bonhoeffer, "This is all fine, but nothing you write has any ethical implication. The great Lutheran doctrine of justification is a nice doctrine, but unless it issues in concrete ethical action in the world, it's empty." And it annoyed Bonhoeffer at first, but it changed him inevitably.
So he returns to Germany. This is the time of great ferment, and Hitler is elected, is in the government, and so from the beginning, Bonhoeffer realizes this is that something's really amiss here in his country, and he has to stand up and say something.
Yes, within several weeks of Hitler's appointment to chancellor, Bonhoeffer issued two public statements in defense of the Jewish people and in opposition to the Nuremberg Laws, and particularly to what was called the Aryan Paragraph, which made it no longer lawful for anyone of Jewish descent to have any employment in the German church or German society. And Bonhoeffer shocked a group of in Germany and in Berlin when, in the late spring of 1933, he said, in response to state violence and the oppression of people on the basis of race and religion, the church is required not simply to bandage the victims who are smashed by the wheels of the state, but the church is required to destroy the wheel itself and to so not only issue declarations and proclamations, but to find concrete ways of opposing these anti-Semitic and indeed these laws that violated civil liberties and civil rights in Germany. He saw with an uncommon clarity that the Führer was not only someone who promised Germans these great kind of fantastic dreams of a national unity and redemption, you know, from the shame of Versailles and from all of the kind of bitterness that was felt in the wake of World War One, but that he would, in fact, become God's agent. And so by the end of the 1930s, baptism services in the German church had phrases that read, "We baptize this child, this baby, in hope that he or she may grow up to live like the Führer." Bonhoeffer saw in 1933 the makings of an enormous catastrophe.
There's so many pieces here, and I want to make sure we have time to fit them in. I want to hit some very key points, and I think that one of them is Eberhard Bethge. Did I say his name correctly? Bethge? Bethge?
Bethge, yeah.
Bethge. And
Bethge, yeah.
And so many people who have written about Bonhoeffer before didn't give him, I think, as much credence and power in his life as you did.
Yeah.
It also had a lot to do with how you came to view and understand not just this great theologian, we'll go back to the theology and ethics and his joining the underground and all the rest of that before he died, but it gave you more insight into the depth of character beyond the theologian.
The depth of character beyond the theologian has often been hidden from view, and I think that what I tried to do in my biography, in fact, I have to tell you what I did do, was when I began the work in the spring of 2007, I took every biography of Bonhoeffer that had ever been written, and I hid them in my basement as a kind of discipline to force myself to see his character and his drama and his struggles anew on the basis of primary documents alone. And we have now thousands of pages of his letters and writings. He was an avid journaler, so we have his notebooks from most periods of his life. And Bethge turned out to be Bonhoeffer's best friend, soulmate, confessor. And later, after Bonhoeffer's death in 1945, Bethge devoted the better part of his life to writing Bonhoeffer's biography and to telling the story in both scholarly and popular form. Bonhoeffer met Eberhard in the summer of 1935 when Bonhoeffer was launching an illegal seminary of this sort of church movement called the Confessing Church. The Confessing Church was a small, but for a while, a potent anti-Nazi movement within the state Lutheran Church. And the seminary, this illegal seminary, was initially housed on an old windswept manor home on the shores of the Baltic Sea. And Bonhoeffer met Eberhard at a reception for new students, and immediately recognized in Eberhard a dear friend, and eventually a soulmate. And for 6 or 7 years, they lived as a kind of a spiritual, as kind of spiritual partners of sorts, and went everywhere together, shared a bank account, shared a room in many years, and were deepest of friends. It's a fascinating relationship which I plumb in my biography with perhaps a little more candor than has been brought to the relationship in the past.
So did some of that come because you actually had a chance to meet Eberhard Berg before he died?
Eberhard was a very dear friend of mine, and I spent time in his home. Eberhard would eventually marry Bonhoeffer's niece, and Renata and Eberhard Bethke had a beautiful house outside of Bonn, Germany, and were quite generous with their time and brought me in shortly after I finished my doctoral dissertation in 1989, and offered me shelter. And Eberhard and I, after lunch, would sit in his office and smoke German cigars. I would try to smoke. I have asthma, so I wasn't very good at pulling it off. And fine, he had all of Bonhoeffer's letters, and even these famous letters that Bonhoeffer wrote his last 2 years in prison, there in his home. And so we pored over those together, and Eberhard spoke very, very generously and very honestly, and I recorded entire conversations in my micro cassette recorder. I am kind of embarrassed to say that I didn't actually have those recordings transcribed until 2006, because at the time I met Eberhard and visited with him, I was interested in other sort of more scholarly matters. And then in the spring and the summer of 2006, I had these transcripts from my interviews with Eberhard finally written out, transcribed, and used those in my work. I also was able to just become friends with Eberhard over the years and to talk with him at various international symposia and at gatherings. He was a lovely, generous soul.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. Welcome back. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, and we'll be talking this hour with Charles Marsh, who's a Commonwealth Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Virginia. He joins us to talk about his new book, Strange Glory, A Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And here's the rest of that conversation.
Now, this letter that arrived in 1934 to Pastor Bonhoeffer from Mahatma Gandhi, the heathen Gandhi, as Lutherans would say, as you wrote.
Yeah.
And then Bonhoeffer is looking at how this also, he thought about this in terms of the Jews, he has thought about this in terms of how the roots of Christianity were in the East, not the West, how the West had diluted it. And this is a very brief but important piece.
It's so important. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, Mark, because, you know, less than a year after the passage of the Nuremberg Laws, as Bonhoeffer, this young German theologian and pastor, is observing the very, very kind of swift embrace of Hitler among the German churches and among, you know, his former students and professors. Bonhoeffer is beginning to see symptoms of great weakness, if not an altogether collapse of the project, if you will, of German Protestantism. I would say even more, Bonhoeffer was beginning to have a sense of personal kind of weariness with Western European Christianity, and was eagerly looking outside the West at pockets of spiritual energy and of peacemaking that was driven by moral and kind of religious conviction. And he had read Gandhi in Reinhold Niebuhr's classes in New York City. He now wanted to go to India to learn about these communities of peacemaking. And Gandhi invited him to come live on his ashram for a period of time. And it was Bonhoeffer's, in fact, lifelong dream to get to India. He was not able to go in the spring of 1934. Instead, shortly thereafter, he was asked to go and set up a community of Christian peacemakers in this small town in the north of Germany that ended up being a seminary for a radical and sometimes anti-Nazi pastors in a town called Finkenwalde. But he absolutely, in kind of an uncanny way, recognized that Western Christianity was kind of coming to an end as some kind of cultural monolithic, form of piety, and that if Christianity was going to have any kind of a future as a vital, life-affirming religion that helped promote human flourishing rather than diminish human flourishing, it would need to be found in other places. And so India became, in Bonhoeffer's mind, a pocket, a place where there might be the sort of sources for renewal in the faith that he professed as a Christian pastor.
So here we have a Bonhoeffer living at home in Germany, and this very critical time, a very tough place to live, and also hard in terms of what was going on with Hitler and the Nazis and rounding up Jews and expelling Jews from universities. And Bonhoeffer has made some very tough choices and hard choices, and was kind of the beginning of this kind of thing called the Confessing Church, which is an important part of the story. Mm-hmm. And also its own internal and external demise of the Confessing Church, and his being drawn to that.
That's right. And it's a very interesting part of the story that in 1939, now, as you rightly indicate, Bonhoeffer is under constant surveillance. His right to teach and to preach and to write and to speak has been revoked. He has received news that his conscription into the German army is forthcoming, and he has every intention of resisting the draft. And of course, there were no conscientious objectors in Hitler's army. This confessing church that Bonhoeffer had helped found, that he had such hopes in terms of forming a robust opposition among the churches to Hitler, had by 1939 almost, completely taken an oath of allegiance to Hitler. This broke Bonhoeffer's heart. And of course, he was a man who was living in a variety of places because he was under such close surveillance. Some friends in New York, Reinhold Niebuhr, Paul Tillich, others, hurriedly helped arrange and to put together a teaching position for Bonhoeffer back at Union in 1939. And so Bonhoeffer accepted and joined this large, immigration of German intellectuals and scholars and artists and scientists to the UK and to the United States. having a sense that he could remain safely in New York for the war years, teaching and writing. But within days of settling into the Prophet's Chamber, as it was called, in the Upper West Side, the Union Theological Seminary, and what appears to have been a heat wave in New York in 1939, Bonhoeffer began to have deep reservations. And 6 weeks later, he penned a letter to Reinhold Niebuhr, and he said, "I have made a mistake in coming to New York. In order to have any voice in the rebuilding of the German state and of the German church after the war, I must return and suffer alongside the dissidents and do everything I can to oppose Hitler." And so he returned to Germany, uncertain what his next move would be. He had, and this is an important part of this decision to return to Germany, received from his brother-in-law, the conspirator and aristocrat Hans von Dohnányi, a record, a confidential record of the Nazi abuses and atrocities. Hans von Dohnányi had used his position at the Military of Justice to obtain these Nazi confidential records, and it was read as a kind of day-by-day listing of war crimes, of euthanasia and eugenics plans, of military plans, of the genocidal actions against the Jews, and the policies of concentration camps, the full realization of which made clear to Bonhoeffer that he must return to Germany, and that, let me add one other thing, that his principled commitment to pacifism up to this point must yield under these extreme circumstances to actions intended to kill the madman Hitler. And he, shortly after, accepted an invitation by Dr. Dohnányi and by his older brother, Klaus Bonhoeffer, to take a role in the conspiracy against Hitler in its plot to assassinate the Führer.
And what you do remarkably in this book, I think, and let me pull out one piece of this, is It's about Bonhoeffer's, the complexity of his life, and the kind of character he was, and the man of character deeply in terms of his resistance to Nazis and to fascism and in Germany. But you also kind of take his theological work and wrap that through this. So there's a continuity between his theological thought, his notion of what Christianity really means in terms of living a life of resistance and fighting for freedom and justice, as well as his own life. And so that to you, so I mean, you've taken like all his theoretical pieces and kind of married them with the moments that he had to stand up.
Well, thank you for noticing that, because at one point in a rather unwieldy 2,200-page draft of the biography, it's only 300-something pages now, I should quickly add, but the first draft contained these, sort of 15 or 20-page little pauses in the action with expositions of his great writings, and that just didn't work at all. It wasn't friendly to the reader, and so what I did in subsequent versions was to try to weave these theological writings into his decisions and to his struggles and to the drama of his life. And I think that makes the writings come alive, and it also gives them a sense of presence and context and vitality that they may not have otherwise. I think, for example, in one astonishing, very short chapter from a book on ethics that Bonhoeffer was writing during these years of resistance and conspiracy, a little chapter called Christ and Good People, when Bonhoeffer begins to wonder, okay, so, I'm a Lutheran pastor and I'm a Christian theologian. I've been trying to wage opposition to the Nazis by creating this group of dissident pastors who would use their whatever influence they had, the churches, to contest the anti-Semitic policies of the Third Reich. But that church, you know, just ran aground with many of the leaders and pastors taking an oath of allegiance to Hitler. And now I'm being invited into the political conspiracy by many men who are humanists, are agnostics, are secularists. And so Bonhoeffer begins to think that there is this notion of the good person that is defined not on the basis of what they specifically believe about God and Jesus Christ and the church, but on their heart, on their actions, on their sensitivity, on their civil courage, on their honesty to see and to engage the social order with conviction for the sake of the coming generation. It's a profoundly important change in his life, and I'm grateful to you for noticing that.
Well, when you write about what he wrote in Ethics and talk about what that really meant, and that was a turning point in Bonhoeffer's thought, and you just write in the book here that he ponders the most difficult and urgent questions. Might extreme actions be required of morally responsible people in extraordinary circumstances and exceptional cases? Why were there more humanists and atheists like his brother Klaus or his cousin Hans than Christians in the ranks of the resistance? How could the integrity of the person be preserved against dehumanizing technologies? How might the creative holiness of all bodily life be safeguarded from Nazi eugenics and euthanasia laws? And you're saying it's not a polemic, because there's a series of kind of his homilies or essays that he wrote. But this is he's really struggling with this, and this is a time when he's not just playing being part of the resistance, but he's at one time part of the resistance that's conspiring to kill Adolf Hitler, and on the other hand, he is a counteragent inside German military intelligence.
That's right.
While they're watching him because they think that his writings are subversive. That's
right.
Crazy.
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating moment, and you've just put this so eloquently. Bonhoeffer, the golden child of Berlin University with two doctorates under his belt by the age of 24 and with numerous writings and complex treatises and the like, is now his encounter with these conspirators, these high-minded men and women who were in many cases driven to the work of justice and civil courage and civil disobedience out of humanistic convictions. He's being, in a sense, educated anew about what it means to live as a person of faith in the world. It means living with a certain kind of humility and a certain kind of openness to the bounty and goodness of compassion in whatever form it takes, regardless of what particular religious banner is waved. And indeed, Bonhoeffer now enters this period when he is a counterintelligence agent. On the one hand, the Abwehr, the German secret police, have recruited him to use his ecumenical and international contacts to gather information about the Allies that might be useful to the Reich. But in fact, what Bonhoeffer is doing in this new freedom to travel outside of Germany after 1940 is using his international and ecumenical contacts, primarily with the Brits and the Americans, to let them know that a conspiracy is in progress. And it was Bonhoeffer's hope, through his friendship with Bishop George Bell of England, to convey to the Allied leaders that a German conspiracy was legitimate, in hope that after a successful coup attempt, the Allies would perhaps cease their bombing for a period of time, continuing to occupy the cities of Germany, but with a sense of enabling a transition into a post-Hitler government. As it turned out, the Allies were not interested in this. The principle of unconditional surrender was firm and unyielding. But this was a most extraordinary period of Bonhoeffer's life, and you can imagine how confused many former many old friends and colleagues were as they saw Bonhoeffer moving in these circles. They thought he might have somehow crossed over to the dark side, and it was only after the war that historians and scholars began to understand the full complexity of Bonhoeffer's involvement in the conspiracy. And quite frankly, Mark, it's only been in the past 10 years that documents enabling a full dramatic kind of rendering of those years have become available.
And so Bonhoeffer is involved in the famous attempted assassination of Adolf Hitler. Is part of this underground movement. What is it called? Abwehr?
The name of the organization is called the Abwehr.
Abwehr. And then himself arrested.
That's correct. He's arrested in the spring of 1943 in his parents' home in Charlottenburg, which is a neighborhood in Berlin. He is initially not arrested, though, on charges related to his involvement in the conspiracy. It took over a year for investigators to piece together Bonhoeffer's connection to the Dohnányi and Klaus Bonhoeffer conspiracy. And in fact, it took the conspiracy attempt of July 20th, 1944, at which point Bonhoeffer had been in prison for well over a year, before Bonhoeffer's name was discovered in a file of documents in a military center outside of Berlin. This is what's called the so-called Zosen files. And at that point, it became clear to investigators for the first time that Bonhoeffer was affiliated with a plot to kill Hitler. And really, if you're looking at Bonhoeffer's letters and papers from prison, you begin to see, after July 20th, 1944, a sense that he knows now that short of an allied liberation of the camp, that he will die at the hands of the Nazis.
And what's so tragic, I think, that he does die at the hands of the Nazis. He's hung in the gallows, forced to be nude and hung, and it comes just before the Allies come and where they could have liberated him. It was that close.
It was that close. There was an understanding among the Nazis and the sinister coordinators of the concentration camps that an Allied invasion and liberation of the camps was imminent. And so you see in that spring of 1945 a quite harrowing intensification of killing and death in the death camps. In fact, in Flossenbürg, where Bonhoeffer was murdered on the morning of April 9th, 1945, in the weeks prior to Bonhoeffer's hanging, the crematoria, there were more than one there, broke because of overuse, at which point bodies were thrown into a large ravine and burned en masse. And 2.5-3 weeks after Bonhoeffer's death, the Flossenbürg camp was liberated. I was able to find, it's an extraordinary document, a report written by an American rabbi and an American Protestant minister who were army chaplains who were among the first to enter Flossenbürg after the liberation. And it is, as you might imagine, a heartbreaking and altogether horrific, horrific account.
At the end of all this, I'm curious. I think this is very important work. It may be the epitome of all the work on Bonhoeffer. And just conclude just for a moment about your reflection on what Bonhoeffer has to say for the 21st century, what comes after us even.
That's such a wonderful question. And I think that in my estimation, one of Bonhoeffer's greatest virtues is the call among people of faith and people who come to the work of mercy and justice out of humanistic convictions and secular convictions to ultimate honesty and civil courage and a passionate love of life. One of the aspects of Bonhoeffer's story and his legacy that so moved me, Mark, is the way his life and the memory of his life bring so many people together in shared admiration of an indisputably authentic witness and a complex and vivid and compelling human being. I mean, no other Christian thinker I know, perhaps with the exception of Dr. Keen, crosses so many boundaries while yet remaining exuberantly, one might even say generously, Christian. And his story brings together liberals and evangelicals, Christians and Jews, Catholics and Protestants, mystics, idealists, romantics, you know, romanticists and activists. And his life and legacy continue to inspire not only lives of faith, but indeed, you know, campaigns and movements for social justice, for human and civil rights. And recently, I'm gratified to see a coterie of bright young scholars and environmental ethicists who have found really helpful resources in Bonhoeffer's writings on creation and the divine kind of beauty of the sacredness of the created order, resources for what might be called eco-theology and environmental ethicists. His more popular works make biblical faith intelligible to believers and unbelievers alike, you know, without reducing complex ideas to cliches. I think at the end of the day, here's a man's faith, here's a person of faith who pursues justice and mercy, but does so in a life that is brimming with joy and happiness, at the same time open to life in all its various dimensions, who I think helps us understand that faith in the best sense unlocks a love of the human, and it may even make us more romantic and more engaged and more passionately involved in human flourishing and in acting in ways that are attuned to how the coming generation is to live. I think in a profound sense, Bonhoeffer is a person of faith for our times.
Well, Charles Marsh, this is an amazing book. I'm so glad you wrote it, Strange Glory, The Life of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. It's great once again to talk to you, and I hope you come back to visit Baltimore soon.
Mark, it's a pleasure to be with you again. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
As always, let us know what you think about today's show. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Show Facebook page, and please email me at steinershow@gmail.com.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.